Hello, friends, and welcome to season two of the Ended Records podcast. This is your host, Ozzy Ronsberger. This season, we will talk in depth about our next release, the reissues of the Better Than a Thousand albums, Just One and Value Driven. This is the second part of our interview with Ken Olin. This episode, we are focusing on the second Better Than a Thousand album, Value Driven, the recording sessions in Ken's bathroom, and the extensive touring the band did in support of the record. And last time when we spoke, we ended with the first and absolutely insane Better Than a Thousand show that you ever played. You took the pictures for the Just One album,
yes,
on Revelation. How long after that show until the record actually came out on Revelation?
You know, it was a few months because, you know, that was probably we'd sent the I think they had done some portraits, and obviously we had all the lyrics and all the text parts done, but all the photography came from that show. So, you know, I'd say a week or so later all the pictures had been selected and sent out, and then it was a few months that the record was finally out. And so by then, we're already sort of thinking, wow, that was incredible. We need to start working on another record, you know, for a lot of reasons, because, what we talked about last time, the way we had done Just One, as magical as it had been, because we never really understood what it was in the beginning, and we kind of stumbled into it unintentionally. I mean, we're lucky that we had success with it, because the way it kind of came about, it could have really been a disaster, because, you know, it started out more or less as a demo. We made the most of it, definitely. But now it's like, okay, we realized, okay, we have this really special band. There's a lot more potential here, and we need to approach this, the writing and the production and everything about the band, we need to approach it as a, you know, with that right focus. But what we didn't realize is that there was like a real hunger in the hardcore world to like hear the Ray of today, you know, vocal style. You know what I'm saying? Like, we did not realize, because, you know, Ray had his style, you know, he was singing more, it was more melodic. It's interesting, because there's that's obviously that style, what Shelter sounds like. It's prettier, it's more, you know, it's catchier, it's poppier, you know, all those things that are, of course, going to appeal to a broader audience. But in the hardcore world, and the hardcore community obviously was always a part of Shelter and supported Shelter the whole time, but there was definitely like this other Ray Capo style, you know, that Youth of Today style, which up close, I didn't realize it, but, you know, when he's in the booth and he's doing like that Youth of Today style vocals, which was kind of crazy sounding, really. I mean, you couldn't understand the lyrics. I mean, it took me a while to just like try to remember the first time I put a Youth of Today record on. I'll never forget. My friend, Issa Jowl, the singer from Good Clean Fun, and one of my old best friends, one of us had bought Break Down the Walls back when it came out in, you know, like 87. And we put it on his turntable, because I was at his house. And I remember the record starts, and we were like, what the hell is this? Like, it sounded so crazy to us. It took us a while. You're reading the lyrics, and, you know, what he's at, you can't make any of the lyrics out when you listen to it. And it was the first time I realized, like, okay, I listen to hardcore punk rock, and this is crazy to me. You know what I mean? Like, it's one thing if, like, your mom or dad, who, you know, grew up on a totally different old style of music, and they can't understand the lyrics. But this is like, we listen to this stuff, and we can't understand what this guy's saying.
So I mean, it had none of that melodic sensibility, especially coming out of DC, right?
Absolutely not at all, right? And that's what was so funny for us. You know, it took me a second to like, like Youth of Today was not an easy listen to when you first put it on. You know, like I think anybody who, it's hard. Everyone who listened to Youth of Today, you gotta almost forget that you've you know, that's like a style and you're comfortable with it, you understand what's happening, try to remember back to that first time you put, that first side and break down the walls on, you know, make a change, you know what I mean? That's, I think that's the first song on side A, you know, it's like when he starts screaming, make a change, it's like, what word was that? You know what I'm saying? Like the word change has like 20 syllables in it, you know?
So here you are like probably exactly 10 years later, right?
Right.
Or around. Right. So you brought that melody, you had the energy, Better Than a Thousand of Music had the energy, but it had also that melodic DC sensibility,
yes,
I think.
Yeah, right.
And then you had his vocals over it. I think that's what made Just One so unique if you look back at it.
Yes, yes. And again, you know, something at the time I didn't really appreciate it. You know, Graham is a more melodic guitar writer than I am. I would say like his natural inclination, he's because he's listening to like, I'm listening to metal. It's not always super melodic. You know, I listened to some of that DC stuff, but he was more so into like that new sort of post original Discord stuff. He's got that kind of jangly melodic style to him that, you know, you really hear on Just One. And even to like, the interesting thing is like Graham and I have, we don't like the same kind of guitar sounds either. So he's got this kind of more open, more melodic sound. My natural inclination is to have like a tougher, meaner, colder guitar tone. You know what I mean? So it's really interesting. It's things that I didn't appreciate at the time. What you're saying is right, but I didn't necessarily realize it while it was happening, which is always, you know, funny.
Because when I went back, you know, and listened to Just One, the guitars sound a lot like Dak Nasty's Can I
Right.
Say. Yes. It sounds like he's almost copying Brian Baker's guitar tone, but tougher.
I think you're right. And I think, and you know, I mean, that was the kind of tone that most DC bands had, you know, the prominent DC, you know, there would be a couple bands that I was in. There really weren't a lot of hardcore bands. And the weirdest thing about DC was that there's this long window where DC has this really vibrant scene. And you'll have, and just so you know, you wouldn't necessarily know this from afar, but if you're in DC, the hardcore scene and the Discord scene operated really independently. And the only times that they would kind of cross over would be when Worlds Collide was around. Worlds Collide and Fugazi would play a lot of shows together because there was a group called Positive Force, and they would do a lot of benefits. And Worlds Collide at the time was sort of the biggest hardcore band in DC. Fugazi was obviously huge, and they were the biggest, you know, they were the biggest band in DC. But those two bands would always get booked together. And so, because if you're doing a benefit and you need the most amount of people to show up and support the benefit, that makes sense. But it was weird because when at the shows, there was a lot of conflict between the crowd that would come to see Worlds Collide and the crowd that would come to see Fugazi. And, you know, I mean, down to the point where, you know, the hardcore kids who are just like regular hardcore kids who go to regular hardcore shows, they like Fugazi, but then if they stage dive, like Fugazi would stop the set and, you know, get mad at the person who stage dived. And it would just be it was weird. It was weird because here's Ian from Minor Threat. So like and obviously if you're in DC, the coolest thing about the Fugazi guys is you see those guys everywhere. I mean, if you go to shows and you're just sort of in the DC underground music scene, you're running into members of, you know, Minor Threat, whoever was still in town, and obviously Ian, Gee, you run into them all the time. Super nice guys, super approachable, you know, but then they didn't want Fugazi to be like Minor Threat where people are getting kicked in the face and, you know, and so, you know, if you're depending on what era you grew up in, you might not quite be where they are, you know.
I mean, they were 5 to 10 years ahead of you guys.
That's right. Yeah. And so, you know, we're younger. We haven't gotten some of this craziness out of us yet, and our fans haven't. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I don't blame them because when they basically started this whole new scene for, you know, that Discord world, the hardcore world was still incredibly violent and dangerous. And it's like, actually looking back, it's like that scene was with no way that scene was as horrible as ours was in terms of just like what could happen to, you know, anybody, any given show. But that being said, you know, that style was definitely the dominant guitar sound and style, that, you know, that Dag Nasty style. Dag Nasty's, you know, their records are coming out back then, and you know, Swizz, of course, you know, so these are like the best guitars in DC, you know, and that was the predominant style for sure.
So when Just One came out, you guys were already back in the basement writing more songs. Is that correct?
Yeah, because Just One comes out, we are able to do a couple, one show. We did one show. I have to work hard to remember this, but if I remember right, we did the one show that was the first show, and then Battery does a U.S. tour, and that tour ends in Los Angeles or San Diego, somewhere down there, and Ray flies out, and we add Better Than a Thousand to that one show, and that became the first West Coast show. And again, it was hyped and it was a great show. And then what we did was, Ray's on tour this whole time. I mean, I think there's one tour he's on tour with, like, No Doubt. No Doubt's like the biggest band in the world at this point. And, you know, I mean, Shelter is on tour just worldwide, and the record's blowing up. It's doing great. Roadrunner is pumping them every place. They're especially huge in Europe. They're especially huge in Brazil, where they are playing with like Sepultura, which is like, you know, that's like U2 in Brazil. Yeah. I mean, it's insane. I mean, the two sold out nights at a stadium. I mean, you know, Shelter is, they're almost like a mainstream, you know, Green Day style band in some places, you know, I mean, they are huge. And so, you know, we understood this guy is, you know, he does not have that much time. He just doesn't have that much time. So we'd find these little pockets and make it happen. The cool part is Ray always wanted to do it. So every time, you know, he'd communicate when he's around, and we would just, you know, we'd take advantage. And he was down to be that active. Because, I mean, I could tell you, if I was coming off of a Shelter tour, you know, being on the road for 6 weeks, and then I only have a week off, and then I'm on the road again for 5 more weeks, you know, I would probably want that full week off. Or if I had that one weekend at home, I'd probably want that. But Ray was actually surprisingly, I mean, he really was enjoying himself, you know, doing Better Than a Thousand.
What do you think his motivation was? Because we all know you don't do hardcore to make money. Like, there's not huge money.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think he just enjoyed it. I mean, we were really fun, just as a unit, really fun group of guys. You know, we had a really, I mean, it was always fun. There was no stress, and it was, you know, it was going to be a fun show. And I think, you know, it is different. You know, I mean, perfect example, you know, I was saying that that Ray was on tour with No Doubt. Well, you know, Tony from No Doubt, he was into hardcore. He was a big Better Than a Thousand fan at the time. And it was crazy because we would do, like, we did this one, we call it the East Coast Weekend. And all this stuff we were doing as a four-piece, you know, I'm on drums. So, this is before we, you know, we realized, wait, we gotta, you know, I need to be on guitar, really, from a music standpoint, if we're gonna be a better band. But you know, Tony would fly out when he would fly out and actually roadie for us. So we did like this one weekend, and you know, it was funny being like on the way to some show in Boston, and you stop off at the mall to get something, and like all these girls are screaming, it's Tony from No Doubt. You know, at that point, you know, this guy's like one of the biggest rock stars in the country, you know.
It's funny.
And he's just like in our van, you know, in a van with like, you know, 10 people, you know, it just was, you know, driving up and down the East Coast. And, you know, it, I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, cause I asked Tony, I said, man, why this guy probably has his own tour bus when he's on the road. And he's like, man, I miss this, is what he said. You know, I miss this kind of tour. You know, like, this is, you know, I guess it's one of those things, like, you just enjoy it. Ray was, you know, Shelter was huge. They're doing stuff at a big scale, you know, tour buses and, you know, big backline, everything, you know, they had everything, big crew, you know, it was mainstream, you know, in terms of like the production.
So you think he just enjoyed going back to basics with
you? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, he wasn't doing it for the money. So, I mean, he just enjoyed the crew that we were together, and he was having a good time. And, you know, he just had to, he could only be doing it for the love of the art. You know, it's like, okay, now the guy's worked his tail off to be in a band like Shelter, who can, you know, play to a good size audience, who can put out this big record, sell hundreds of thousands of records. You know, it's like, that's what hard work can do for you, you know, and you deserve that. You know, there's no gun to anybody's head forcing them to buy a Shelter record or buy a Shelter shirt or go to Shelter show, you know, and so he's, and also Shelter, the thing I always respect about Shelter is every record, they broke norms, you know, they didn't, you like that from the first record, every record was like, it was a risk, you know, they would take risks, you know, it wasn't cookie cutter the way, you know, it sort of can be in the hardcore world. I mean, like if you're better than 1,000, you know, if I have to write a better than 1,000 record, you know, there's certain parameters that I know are kind of, you know, it's not going to have a horn section. You know what I mean? It's not going to have a hip hop song on it. It's not going to have, you know, I mean, like, I got to write a hardcore record. Like, I have a box. There is a box somewhat. You got to respect the fact that they were not afraid to try new things. And they had great success sometimes. And sometimes they didn't. But you know, I think as an artist, you can't be afraid to try something new. And I think and knowing those guys personally, especially Ray, you know, he's a guy who kind of gets tired of doing the same old thing, to be honest. Like, yeah. I know him well. I feel like I can say that. You know, if he's doing the exact same thing for too long, he, you know, gets a little bored with himself. He'd stop. He doesn't feel like you know, there's no challenge if it's too easy, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, Ray could do a Youth of the Day style hardcore band forever and have a certain amount of success. And there would be fans who that's what they want to hear and they'll keep showing up. But he's not satisfied for himself, you know, because it's not, he, you know, he wants to try something different and explore. And he's got kind of like an adventurer side to him, you know, and that's what you see in his musical career, you know, which I thought I always respected.
Sorry, linking that back to Value Driven, which you recorded, did you think you guys made a step and got a little bit more adventurous?
Okay, well, a couple things. See, I felt like the first record was sort of like was sort of random. Graham's writing a hardcore band, you know, the music that you know, cool, really cool, interesting hardcore songs, but without any without really knowing what path it's going down. Now, once you have Ray in it, you know, you have this special thing that we have a little bit of success. You know, we have this sort of machine, you know, it's punk. I mean, it's hardcore and punk rock and it's underground, you know, but we have this, you know, we know what it is, you know? So when I felt like with Value Driven, we're getting a little more focused. And then, all of a sudden, instead of the one thing I used to do in Battery, because Brian wrote almost all the lyrics. I wrote all the music. Brian wrote almost all the lyrics. But the one thing I would do in Battery is I would write the lyrics to like the sort of hardcore anthem of the album, or maybe like the title track. But you didn't necessarily know it was going to be the title track. But like, you know, I wrote the lyrics to Only the Die Hard Remain. I wrote the lyrics to Until the End, Whatever It Takes, which actually were all the title tracks now that I think about it. But but the reason I'm saying that is because I was good at writing like that sing-along song, you know, that anthem, you know. Brian's writing these incredible heartfelt lyrics. I'm not good at that, okay, per se, but I'm really good at writing like a really cool hardcore sing-along song that could be like an anchor on the record, you know, hold this whole thing down, you know. You know, I wrote the lyrics to No More Dreams for Damnation, you know, like it's like I when I'm writing the lyrics, I'm seeing it as a live show in my mind, you know, like obviously I wrote the music, but when I'm writing the lyrics, I'm imagining it as a show, you know, I'm not sitting there just writing lyrics. I'm actually visualizing what the audience exchange might look like, and then I'm writing the lyrics to that makes sense for what I'm imagining or what I hope will happen, you know. And so with Value Driven, I realized that, okay, and by the way, at this point, I'm not really writing battery songs anymore. So all, and that was the issue when we were doing, when Graham wrote Just One, I'm still writing battery songs. But now when we're doing Value Driven, I have this whole, like, my side of the hardcore music is opened up, because I didn't want Battery and Better Than a Thousand to compete musically from my perspective, right? So it's sort of a, you know, like a, it's a, it might be an arbitrary line to draw in the sand, you know, because, but it's like, I'm only good, if I think I'm only good for like an album of great hardcore songs, I don't want to split my attention and then I have subpar material, you know?
So at this point you were actually able to focus fully on.
Exactly. So all of a sudden when we're doing Value Driven, you know, I'm starting to realize that, you know, it's probably good if we split the writing, because I think if each of us needs to come up with like 5 or 6 great songs, that's going to give us one better album than if I try to write the whole thing, or if Graham tries to write the whole thing. Like both of us, we're both good songwriters. So if we can both split the writing duty, it's going to help us, you know, it's going to help the album. So I think that helps Value Driven in a general sense, but also in a more specific way, we knew what we were doing now. We knew exactly where this record kind of could go in terms of, you know, you got Ray of today singing, you got, you know, we you can envision the whole thing. So it kind of motivates you, and it just made us focus more, you know.
That's also when you made like a conscious decision to record differently, correct?
Yes. Well, so a couple things happened. So Shelter is getting bigger and bigger, but Better Than a Thousand ended up being a little more successful than Roadrunner wanted it to be. You know, they, a lot, you know, one thing that we kept seeing whenever we would travel or pull up, you know, magazines that would review metal and hardcore and underground music, you would see a lot of times that Mantra and Just One would get reviewed like right next to each other. Like it sort of helped the two records, I think. I mean, one thing that was interesting is I think it helped Shelter in the sense that you could see that this singer in this big band still has this, like, he's really got his thumb on the pulse of the underground still, you know. Mm-hmm. I felt like Shelter's very kind of, at that point with Roadrunner, it's very high production, you know. I mean, they're doing really well.
So you think that Better Than a Thousand kind of gave them that street credibility?
I think it didn't hurt them. I don't think it hurt them, you know. I thought that, you know, I think if and it might just be my perspective, maybe it's something that I want to believe, you know. I don't know, you know.
Honestly, from a fan perspective, but I think it wasn't Mantra. I think it was already Beyond Planet Earth.
Well, that's right.
And that was like this super poppy record.
That's what I'm getting at. That's
so exactly I agree as a fan, both of Shelter, when that, and we're talking pre-internet, like, yes. 97, the internet was not even, you know, I didn't even have an email address, I assume.
Right.
So
right.
A friend of mine came home with the Better Than a Thousand record and put it in my lap, and I didn't even know it existed.
Right.
It's the first time I saw it. So that was pretty much when Beyond Planet Earth came out. So for me, it had absolutely had that effect. It was like the sugar that helped me swallow the bitter Beyond Planet Earth pill.
Right. Well, so what was interesting was the first record did a little better and was a little more successful than Roadrunner wanted. And we realized, and they actually specifically had told Ray they don't want him doing Better Than a Thousand anymore. Okay, so he got the official word from like top, like, we don't want you doing this. And so, you know, but Ray, I mean, to his credit, he was like, you know, ending Better Than a Thousand just because some suit at a label tells you, you know, you can't do that. That's the sellout move. Instead, Ray's like, you know, screw them. You know, I mean, I don't know if he specifically said that, but he's like, let's just do it, but we got to keep it. Needs to come across as more DIY, you know. And and having it on Revelation was like way too high profile. Mm-hmm. So that's when we realized, we're like, okay, this record, we're gonna make it better, we're gonna make it more focused, but we're also gonna do this like even more underground. And that's when we decided to do it ourselves. We literally did everything ourselves. No label. We were the label. We recorded ourselves. We wrote it, recorded ourselves, released it ourselves. Pressed it ourselves. We hired a publicist to help make sure people knew it was out. We did everything ourselves. And I was always the kind of business guy in the band. So when I say we did everything ourselves, I took care of all the stuff I just named. Those guys recorded and wrote. They did their parts, like, in terms of the and we all agreed on what our steps were. Like, we talked about a course of a strategy, and then I tried to find the right distributors. I tried to find the right pressing plants, and it actually worked pretty well.
Is that actually like what brought you to your bathroom?
yes, it is. So we knew when we're starting, we're in these hardcore bands, but we normally what would happen is we obviously could have gone back to Revelation, say we want to do another record or some other label, and they would send us some recording money so we could book studio time and do all this stuff. Now, at this point, a couple years earlier, I actually had a studio set up, but it had been completely dismantled. I didn't have a lot of that equipment, but I did have some of it, and I had enough of it where I was able to, put it together. I mean, but it wasn't like even in racks. It's just like stacked up on the floor, and wires are going in and out of different rooms. So we started, Graham and I start with the music, and I set the drums up in my bedroom and mic'd them all up, and Grant set up an amp. I used my bathroom. It's like, so imagine you have, decent sized bedroom and a bathroom off of it. The bathroom ends up being the isolation booth, which I'm sure is how a lot of home studios are set up. It's not crazy, but it was funny back then, because this kind of made sense at the time. It's like, Graham lives right up the street. We can kind of work on this album, put it together slowly, and then track it. So we, Graham and I probably spent, a few weeks writing it. And then we tracked all the music over probably, I want to say I had the drum kit set up for maybe 2 days. And we had all the drums recorded, and then Graham and I would do the music. And then it was cool. Jeff, who was playing bass live, he hadn't played on any of the records, but he'd come and hang out while we tracked the bass, and we'd show him the parts, because these are songs he'd be playing. The whole thing happened basically in my bedroom in the bathroom, and then when we finally, Ray came down, we sent him the songs, and then I'd say, maybe a few weeks or a month later, he came down, but he was able to hang out for a lot longer. I think we broke it up maybe into two sessions even. Okay. So we had more time, and we broke it up, so it wasn't all like one trip. But he came in and was like super prepared. Some of the songs were practically one take, just all. And I remember, like, Ray would be in, it was funny. Ray would be in the bathroom with the door closed, and me and Jeff and Graham would be in the bedroom listening, and kind of had it set up. It was like a little bit of isolation, but I mean, it was not a real studio, minimum effort. And I remember, I'll never forget, Ray would get done with the take, and we would, the three of us would be getting so excited in the bedroom, because we'd hear like that awesome, like Youth of the Day style, like crazy scream. It was awesome to hear it live, and just watch this guy just, do his thing. He's so good at that. And he was totally delivering all the stuff, like, If you're playing hardcore and you grew up listening to Youth of the Day, like I did, or Graham or Jeff did, and years later you're in the band with this guy who the singer, and then you hand him some blank instrumentals, hey man, put some vocals on this. Like, that's what you wanted to hear. Like, it was interesting recording value driven, because that was more, I felt it kind of put me back to being a fan, mm-hmm. Like listening to Ray in the quote unquote booth, it made me like, I was getting into it, not just as like a guy in the band. Like, I was really enjoying what he was doing, and getting excited, because I was like, man, this is freaking awesome. this is gonna be a great record. I mean, because he was doing all the stuff that people who know his other bands would hope. That's what you, when you buy that record, this is kind of what you were hoping it would sound like, you know?
Yeah.
And so I felt really strong about it.
So you recording this record, you know, you have a great record at hand, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've been so successful with record number one and working with Revelation. Were you bummed out that, you know, you couldn't shop the record around?
You know, it's so weird because it always was a project to us. So we never had, and it's funny when you have, if you have an expectation, you're not disappointed. It's like, okay, if you and me go and see a movie, you know, when this pandemic ever ends, you know, if you were in DC and I'm like, oh, Izzy, let's go catch this movie. You know, it's Rambo 6. Okay. Rambo 6 is out.
I'm down.
Right. Now, you know what the deal is. You know, it's this character and it's going to be ridiculous. And the guy's going to shoot an arrow and a whole city's going to blow up from this one arrow. And you know, all these silly things are going to happen. So your expectations are kind of dialed into like a particular place. You're not expecting, you know, an Oscar nomination, you know, when you see this thing, you know, like you know what you get, you know what I mean? And so I'm saying that to say that, you know, we did not expect anything with Better Than a Thousand. So, and our expectations, even though we knew it was awesome, like at this point, we know like people like it. We got one of the best hardcore singers of all time. And we were really pumped up about it. We always understood like Ray is in Shelter. Shelter is a huge band that can, you know, we could get a call and they could be on tour for the next 18 months. And that was one thing about Better Than a Thousand, which was cool, was that a lot of the shows felt like events, you know, because it was so limited and you really didn't know how or when the band would play.
So how did you then make the decision on how to release Value Driven in that scenario, like knowing that the band can end at any time?
Well, so, you know, the tricky thing was always figuring out how much time Ray had and how much time he was willing to put in. Now, what we had working against us was he's in Shelter. Shelter is a big full-time band. But what we had, he wasn't doing a ton of the yoga stuff yet. So what was sort of interesting was that his primary sort of, his primary occupation was singer in a band. So when Shelter had these long gaps, all of a sudden that created an opportunity where, you know, he had a good amount of time there. And as long as it made some sense, you know, he wasn't going to get rich, but you know, as long as it's like, he's not like losing his shirt going out with us, you know, there was no reason to say no. And the other thing that it always helps. It's just like, you know, I think you see it in sports. There's an expression that like winning solves everything, or, you know, you could have you could have tension in a team locker room, but if the team's winning, that tension goes way down. And see, if, you know, team's losing, the tension, you know, then the tension bubbles to the top. And the one thing we always had going for us is we always had good shows. I mean, Better Than a Thousand would get good. We always had good crowds, good opportunities, good offers. You know, we were, for that style of band, you know, I mean, we're not going to play, we don't sound like Coldplay, but for a hardcore band, you know, we were kind of maximizing what you could do as a band. And so that was good because the one thing that was really good about Better Than a Thousand, we had all spent many, many years playing hardcore, sort of fine tuning our skills, understanding hardcore, you know, touring the world, meeting and seeing other hardcore bands all over the world. So I'm saying all that to say that, you know, at this point where we've been doing all this stuff for, you know, more than a decade, almost 20 years for Ray, you know, we were pretty good at that. You know, we made a decision to make Better Than a Thousand this like more, we kept it simple in the sense that, you know, we whipped these songs off that we felt in our hearts and were high energy. Ray did the same with the vocals and the lyrics. And we didn't need a lot of rehearsal before a tour. We could practically all just land and do a sound check and we were ready for tour. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, so, and that also makes it really easy. Like, I don't know that looking back, I don't know that Ray ever rehearsed ever for a Better Thousand show tour. He may never have done that. He might have gone, you know, in the studio, he's checking out lyrics. But as far as like a band practice, I don't think he ever rehearsed with us. Or if he did, he might have just been listening to just, you know, hear the timing of like segues between songs or something. But, you know, but he didn't need to, you know. I mean, that's the thing. The guy, he didn't need to. He's got that in his blood, you know.
His dad also gave you guys the, you know, confidence to just release the record yourselves?
You know, I felt like, I mean, that could have, I can't say we had confidence. I felt like we didn't have a choice. But we also knew we have a great record. We got a band that people have interest in. And as long as we can make it accessible, like it has to get into stores and people have to know it's out. But if people can know it's out and can get their hands on it, they're going to want it because it's a step up from the last thing that they already enjoyed. And with Value Driven, the one thing that we had going for us on Value Driven, which probably helped, is that one of the primary distribution routes was us playing shows. So it was interesting because, you know, if we're selling 100, 200 copies of a CD every time we play, you know, that helps. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, it starts making more sense to do a 3-week tour here, a 3-week tour there. You know what I mean? Because actually, this is our best way to sell this thing might be at the show, you know? And so, you know, that probably helped us to do a lot more live stuff on that record, which we did. I mean, we did the Rev Tour in North America. We did a Battery, Better 1000 tour in Europe. You know, all in that year that, you know, once Value Driven came out. And those were great tours, great shows.
I mean, there's footage of you guys playing Dynamo Festival. Played these gigantic festivals in Italy or Spain.
It was unbelievable. Right. Playing with Metallica. I mean, we had, and that's what I'm saying, like, and that's all on the Value Driven stuff, you know? So now I'll tell you, there's a woman named Marlena who used to work at, she did work at Roadrunner in Europe. And I have not spoken to her almost since back in these days, but she recommended this one publicist to us. And it was crazy because I don't know what Rolodex this guy had, but this guy got that record. He said at the beginning of the tour, I said, how many copies of this do you need for promo? And he asked for a lot. I mean, hundreds of copies. But, you know, it's one of these things. It's like, if I ask a label for hundreds of copies, they maybe don't want to do that. But because they're thinking about like the cost. But for me, and, you know, it's like our actual cost on a CD back then, you know, I can't remember, but it wasn't crazy. You know, if you're pressing thousands, it's, I don't know, a dollar or two a disc or something. I can't remember, but something reasonably low. And as the band, it's like, you know, hey, I'd spend $600 of my own dollars of content to and hope this guy can do it. I mean, just as an example, one of our old labels, I won't even say who, but that same guy asked for promo for on a similar tour that was happening at the same era, that same window. Mm-hmm. He asked for, and that label sent him 2 copies and we sent him 300 copies. And it was crazy because I literally experienced what it's like when you only sent 2 copies of promo out. And then when you sent 600 copies or 300 copies of promo out, and it was a big difference. I mean, every time Better 1000 got to a venue, there was somebody from a radio station there to interview Ray or somebody, sometimes a TV station, you know, there's a bunch of interviews to do and all the magazines. When that tour was over, I had a stack of magazines that was probably a foot high of reviews. And it was unbelievable. Like this guy, and I want to say that guy, you know, this is obviously 20 years ago or, you know, more, but I mean, I think it was like $750, you know? So basically for, you know, $750 is one time payment to a publicist who this guy just was like, dream publicist, you know, and
just doing you guys a favor because he probably liked the project.
Yeah. It was easy for him. And he, you know, I mean, $750 might've just covered, you know, half of that would have gone to postage. You know what I'm saying? So he didn't make any real money. Yeah. He definitely was a favor. He's just helping out a cool project, you know? And man, that it was amazing. And so we got, that was luck, because all I did was, I mean, anyone, I would have pretty much rolled with whatever publicist had fallen into my lap.
And this guy just fell into your lap.
And it was I just got lucky. We got the right referral, and, you know, and that guy he really did it. And so we got lucky because at the end of that tour, he had done such a great job with the publicity. That record got licensed to Epitaph at the mm-hmm. time. You know what I'm saying? So yeah. It's like, wow, you know, like we just got done selling all these records all over the world. You know, I mean, Better Than a Thousand in that window, we're down in Asia, we're in South America, we're in Europe, we're in America. So we, you know, we're hitting every place where there's a scene for us to play. And then when we get done with all that, Epitaph comes and, you know, re-releases it. So it was like, you know, it was a
double win.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, so the irony was, it's to answer your question, you know, were we afraid to release it? You know, I can't say, I felt like we didn't really have a choice, you know. We didn't want to get Ray in trouble with what was his main, you know, his main boss at that point, you know, or not he's, you know, Shelter's the boss of themselves, but, you know, that label has a lot of say on, you know, what happens with the band and where they go and what kind of investment they're going to make in Shelter. So, you know, we didn't want to get him in trouble with Roadrunner. But Ray, you know, he made a pretty somewhat risky decision, you know, to because he could have easily said, man, I'm getting a lot of heat. I got to really take a break and let's maybe do it again in a year or two. You know what I mean? And that would have changed everything.
Yeah. But then Ray is not known for, you know, being bossed around. Like he was
right. Well, that's right. No, he did what he wanted to do. And, you know, that's the one thing. I mean, that was a punk hardcore decision, and it, you know, in keeping with a lot of the lyrics and, you know, demand independence and all that. Like he did not capitulate. Like we understood, like, okay, there's a path that we can do this, and this is how we got to do it. But I mean, I don't know that we sold fewer records than we did on Rev. Maybe we sold more. You know, I don't know. I mean, I literally don't know, but I'm just saying, like, if you were out and seeing the, you know, how many were selling every night and the songs people want to hear, and, you know, it was just as successful, you know? You know, now Rev, the difference is Rev this whole time has kept that record in press, whereas the Value Driven kind of has gone out of press because we were the label. And once we stopped paying attention, you know, it just fades, you know? Right.
So you probably went on the most successful year you ever had with that band, completely unexpected.
Yes, I would say so.
And so in 99, there's a bunch of, you know, you did a bunch of 7-inches and, you know, contributed songs to compilations. And then it must have been 99, it ended kind of, you know, on a sour note from the outside. That's the outsider perspective, with an incident in Italy that back then, you know, as far as scene politics go, was blown out of proportion, I think. Would you like, can you explain what happened and what your take on it was?
Well, it was, you know, I mean, I, you know, I can only, you know, I'm not even sure I remembered exactly correctly, because it was really weird. If you were there in the room and with the band, it didn't even seem like anything had happened. Like basically, you know, back then at the time, we were on tour, we're in Italy, and we stopped at some small village to get like a quality Italian pasta meal. I mean, in Italy, especially if you're vegetarian and, you know, that food is just so incredibly good. Like even the most basic, you know, pasta with just like a little olive oil on it, it just will taste. It's like, I don't know what's going on down there. Like why you can't eat something that tastes the same anywhere else. But if you're in Italy, I mean, just.
They got that most down. That's true.
Yeah, it's a, you know, and if you like to eat, which I mean, we all, that's like probably our favorite thing to do, you know, is on tours, get a good meal. So, you know, we eat this, we sit down, and I've only seen this happen a few times, but in that particular restaurant, they had put, when you sit down, just like in America, for example, they might bring everybody at the table a glass of water. There, they bring everyone this little tiny glass, like it's a little, it almost looks like a shot glass. It's so small. And And you don't know what it, you know, the guy comes around with this little thing and it looks like it's like grape juice, but it, or some, but it actually was some type of like little sip of red wine in each one of them. And it was one of these things, like everyone's looking at each other like, oh man, this guy's pouring wine for everybody. You don't want to like offend them, you know what I mean? And waste it. But it was weird because, you know, pretty much like everybody's like straight edge and you know what I'm saying? There was like this weird moment that is rare. It's one of these things like, you know, nobody's about to order a bottle of wine and get wasted all of a sudden. But a couple people at the table like said, well, I'm not going to offend this guy. And they took that little sip of wine and that was it, you know? But for some weird, and I mean, I hate the taste of alcohol personally. So, you know, I would not have drank it no matter what because I can't stand the taste. And I never have. I never drank. I've never been drunk, you know, my whole life. Like me being straight is actually pretty easy because I hate the taste of alcohol. But, you know, Ray drank that little sip. I think one or two other guys at the table did, you know, it was a tour and the roadies and everybody. And for some weird reason, yeah, it just kind of like, I don't know, seemed like that moment really bothered our bass player, Jeff. And he just kind of kept that. And I don't even know, you know, it's weird. I haven't talked to him about this recently, but I think if I did, I think he would think that his reaction was like a little overblown. But yeah, he, you know, more or less went back. And the thing that was weird, that happened in Italy. And that was like late in a European tour. That tour finishes. Then we go to South America. And he left, I think the tour after that was South America. He left South America early. And that's how he left the band. Now, he had also been like assaulted in Sao Paulo. Like some guys tried to mug him and he was a little freaked out from that, which I don't blame him. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, when he got back, Sao Paulo is dangerous, but when he got back to America, you know, but when we got back from that tour, there was a whole bunch of people who were saying it was weird. Like all of a sudden you're hearing from people, you know, the usual kind of hardcore scene gossip. And so we're hearing about it. And what we were hearing when we get back is that was the issue, that little wine sip in Italy, which, you know, to be honest, from my perspective was weird because we kept being all together for weeks and weeks and weeks after that. You know what I'm saying? So I didn't know. I never understood, you know, at the time when I got back, I've seen Jeff a couple of times, but the first thing I did when I got back and understood what was happening, I just called and said, you know, if you know, you guys are friends, you guys are boys, like we're all friends. So if there's a problem with something, just pick the phone up. You know, everybody has each other's numbers. So it doesn't, to me, it didn't make sense for anybody to be hearing about that third hand and hear about it in a kind of distorted, overblown manner, especially since I was there and it wasn't that strange. Mm-hmm. You know, there was some nuance to it.
It probably also was like the early days of, you know, group chats and the internet.
Right? It was all of that. Yeah. And you know, I never was like an internet social network guy ever. So even now I'm not really. So it's like, you know, I never really understood that because I'd much rather call somebody. If I have a problem, I'd rather call them. If I'm confused about something, I'd rather call. I just would rather figure something out directly with whoever the parties are. And I think if you're in a band and you're with guys all the time, I mean, you have to do that because it's like, you know, there'll be constantly problems if guys are not keeping the communication direct and clear between each other. So you know, there was definitely like, and you know, there might have been, it's one of these things like sometimes there's other issues like, you know, that, And someone's using that as, and I can't say that that's what this was, you know, don't get me wrong. You know, but it's almost like, you know, maybe there's some other, you know, sometimes people use something that small as like
his way out, an excuse.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, it's like, was that as meaningful as he maybe said it was? You know, I think if I talk to him now, he would think that.
I would agree. But was that actually what ended the band, or was the band ending around that?
Well, so no, that didn't end the band. So, you know, he left early. We were in South America, and we finished that tour, Graham on bass. So we finished as a four piece. And then we did some more tours when we went and played with Metallica and some other huge stuff. And we did that with a buddy of ours named Daniel Larson. But yeah, anyway, so then, you know, we did all those tours and those were great. Everybody had fun. And then what happened, we got back from that and Graham and I and Alex, we start writing a third album. And we actually wrote and completely recorded a third Better Than a Thousand record. And Ray actually started coming down and doing vocals on it. And so one of the songs that's on your record, What Are We Competing For, is the first song that Ray sang that he finished. But the one thing is that you could tell, and I've been around Ray a lot. We were doing like way too much. And he was starting to shift away from the music day to day and start getting into starting his yoga career. And so you could tell he was, you know, getting a little burnout on the amount of the workload that we were bringing. You know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, here's another album. And then we want to do, and see, what was interesting is that third album would have been the album where it's, you know, now at this point I own a big studio. It's going to get recorded properly. Where the Beyond Planet Earth had kind of put Shelter on hiatus. So Shelter's not really after that anyway. You know, and at that point it was a really tricky thing for the whole music world because digital's coming out, you know, piracy's coming, you know, big, and labels are starting to lose a lot of sales to digital piracy. So, you know, like there's a whole flux in the music world from a label perspective anyway. So, you know, it's like a good transition period, and Ray's moving away from singing, being a singer as a day-to-day profession and starting to move more into his yoga career, which, you know, he's amazing at that also. So, it's interesting because me and Graham and Ray and Alex, like there was never any bad blood, and we always have been in touch this whole time. When we got done with all that Better Than a Thousand stuff, I mean, we had done so much. I mean, we had done way more touring with that Value Driven run than anybody could have thought. I mean, we were a full-time band. We were, you know, we were in every territory that hardcore can bring you, you know. And it's one of these things, like, there's always going to be offers. You're always going to get phone calls. There's always going to be somebody calling saying, you know, there's always going to be a great show or reason to do it. So it could easily go on forever unless you really make a decision to like just shut it down for a while, which is what happened, you know. Being on tour all the time, I mean, it can, I mean, you know, anyone who's been either in bands, around bands, on the road, managing, you know, it can get, you can need a break from it for a lot of reasons, you know. It's not the most healthy lifestyle, even if you're a vegetarian, straight edge, you know, pretty healthy, health conscious, you know, it's still not that healthy because, you know, you can't exercise when you want or need to. You can't, the food you eat is kind of, you're at the mercy of what the club provided or maybe a shop within walking distance of the club. You know, I mean, you could easily eat pizza as a main meal every day for weeks. It's like, you know, you start feeling kind of like unhealthy, you know, it can wear you down. I can't blame anybody who wants to take a break from that. You know, there's a lot of fun things about it, but there's plenty of things that you could want to, you know, put to the side for a little while. So, I could never fault him for wanting to do that. I mean, what good is a ton of money and you don't have any time to enjoy? You know, there's a lot of people who have these incredible careers and they don't really have time to enjoy themselves. You know, they're working themselves into the ground, yeah. You know? There's no question. Like, it's finding that balance is everything. You know, that's definitely what that the name of the band was about. A lot of Ray's lyrics are about, you know, you have to figure out what's important to you and then really fight to create that space around it. And just, you know, be true to yourself and be a positive person, because when you have positive energy, you attract positive things to you, you know. You know, people who are, it's interesting, you know, just anecdotally, you know, some people are just always in crisis and you can't, you know, it's like from a distance, it looks like they just have this bad luck, but actually it's just crisis prone energy is just going to attract more of it. And the opposite is true also. Like, you, some people seem like they always have their act together, and maybe that's part of it. You know, you just, you know, you focus on the right type of energy and the positive things come to you, and you reciprocate with that positive energy and the positive people, you know, you surround yourself with the positive group of people. Cause that's what's, you know, it's amazing. The couple times in my life where I've had to pick the phone up and call some of my old bandmates and we say, hey, you know, let's do this again, or let's do that, or let's, you know, I mean, it's kind of funny how guys have grown up, we're older, guys have families. But it's the same guy, you know what I mean? Like, you know, if I call up Graham, my conversation, how I know him, we're the same as we were 25 years ago, you know? It's still like, these guys are like my brothers, you know? Like, it doesn't really matter how much time goes by between playing a show, playing, you know, doing a record, whatever we do, it's like our core is the same, mm-hmm. you know? I get on the phone with Ray. It's the same guy I met in 88, you know, I mean, which is, you know, and that's not true with everybody, you know, some people change. And I mean, we've changed, you know, we're not exactly the same, but our core is basically the same. And, you know, and that's why it makes it so easy to, we're going to do better than 1,000 shows later this year, hopefully, if the pandemic lets us. And, and, you know, we're excited about that. It's cool to call all those guys up. And first of all, everybody's psyched, you know, like the idea is exciting to them. You know, it's like a positive thing. And they know, you know, because we're a core group of guys who always try to be positive and just sort of, you know, enjoy a situation, you know, make a positive thing out of a situation. You know, it's like, for me, it's fun for me to have any reason to get back into a band and get back into a van, be back on a stage with this group of guys. You know, it's like, you know, that's probably the coolest part of being in a band, is being around people that you truly enjoy being around, you know?
Awesome.
And so for me, it's like, you know, I would get in a van and a bus or a plane or what, you know, with these guys pretty much for any reason, you know what I'm saying? So it doesn't, you know, like they're all really great guys to be around. And it's like it's never work, you know, like if I have to, you know, we got to rehearse the songs, learn them again, rehearse, make sure we're good, make sure, you know, we're going to put on a great killer set. But you know, it's not going to feel like work, because it's fun. I'm hanging out with my boys, you know what I'm saying? So
perfect.
So it's awesome. So we're excited. And I have to say, always, your involvement has been really amazing for not just me, but for the whole band, because the energy that you kind of, we talked for a while, you know what I mean? And there was like that slow beginning process, but like that really cool positive energy that you were giving me, like, totally changed what could have been like kind of a, you know, low effort, oh yeah, here's some masters, let's repress it. But I realized, man, this is a really cool, you're giving me like this spark that's opening up new creative energy in me to go back and do things to those recordings that wouldn't necessarily have been done. Like, you know, I mean, you know that those records are, you know, remixed. The one record, I think I recut all the guitars on it. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, like, yeah. A lot of work went into it.
Yeah, it's you know, and it's like, I'm doing it from a point of like, it's pleasure, it's pleasing to me to have that opportunity and to even get the, that creative spark, you know, to want to go back and, you know, those couple little things that like could have been better. It's like, this is actually an opportunity to fix those things. And
it's a real labor of love. That's for sure.
I got that immediately all the times in the emails and on the phone, you know, like this is, it's good. It's good. Cause that's what, you know, like you're creating like that spark in me, but then that same energy is how when I'm talking to all the other guys and getting them ready, you know, first I got to get them ready to re-release the record, but now, you know, I got to get them ready to play some shows. You know, it's like, but I'm giving them that energy. It's like, it sort of gets to my point. Like when you put the right energy out, anything's possible. You know what I mean? Like Better Than Thousand could easily never have played another show ever, you know, even though we're all friends and we talk to each other and, you know, I'll see these guys if they're ever in my area or I'm in their cities, but you know, it has to come together for the right reasons, the right energy. Like there's a time for everything. The timing has to be right. And these are all things that, you know, just like somehow the universe just creates like a window and, you know, the sun shines on you and you're ready to get that energy to say, hey, this is that moment, you know? And you definitely, you know, you and NHITS Records has definitely been part of that catalyst.
Awesome.
You know, which has been super cool, you know, because I've worked with a lot of labels and I had to say, you know, I know you're, you know, this isn't an ad for you, but I just want you to say, I just want you to know, because I haven't said this to you, but you know, when I got Capo on the line the first time and said, you know, this is what we got to do, I said, man, this guy is so freaking cool. The way he wants to do the record, he's coming with such really cool energy, and he really, really has his heart in this release. You know what I'm saying? And you know, we've been on a lot of labels, and I can't always say that. You know what I mean? We've been collectively, I don't know how many labels, you know, we've been on. So this has been a really cool process with you and with your label, and we're really excited to be a part of it. And obviously for the record to come out and everything that you've done so far has been amazing. So, I mean, we expect it to just stay like that. And then, you know, of course, take it live. You know what I mean? That's the key.
That's the key. But awesome. But thank you guys for, you know, taking a chance, because it's a big chunk of your legacy and it's a big chunk of my personal legacy and history. So those two worlds coming together is a huge project for me. That's for sure.
That's great, man. We're happy to hear. We won't let you down.
Perfect. I think that's actually the perfect spot to end the interview, right? We covered so much ground. I think we went over almost everything, right?
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I can talk, man. You know that about me.
Awesome.
Hopefully.
All right. Okay, thanks a lot for taking the time.
No problem.
And you and the family be healthy and safe.
Thank you. Same to you. I'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you very much for listening to the NHITS podcast. If you enjoyed this episode as much as we did, please send us feedback, share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast, or give us a review. Stay safe and take care.